had pretty straightforward.
So these teams went for it.
We're here today. This is the Subcommittee on Human Services. Eric, are you on?
Yes.
This is the Subcommittee on Human Services, May 7th, 2015. Our agenda today is a public hearing, and a public hearing only on Senate Bill 454. Just for full disclosure, there are still things in this bill that are being worked on outside of this room. We all know that in Ways and Means, we don't do any policy issues. Wink, wink. But we do what we have to get the job done right, okay? The bill that I'm looking at right now, as far as discussion today, is the A28, which we'll, I expect we'll have some amendments before we're through with this. We will have a public testimony today. If we don't get to all the public testimony today, which I hope we do, but if we don't, we will then carry public testimony over till Monday. But nobody will be able to sign up on Monday. If you're not signed up today, you don't get to have any public testimony on Monday. We want to cover everybody. I believe we can get through public testimony today and bring it back for a work session sometimes next week. That said, LFO, do you have any other guidance for us?
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, I will note we have a variety of amendments to look at on OLIS. So we have the A25s, which are the old version. We have A29s, which are slightly tweaked for a policy change. And then the A28s are actually the A29s exactly, but with the fiscal appropriations added.
So that's as clear as mud. Thank you. Basically, I think what you just said is the A28s and A29s are essentially the same
policy,
with the exception that the 28s have the fiscal on it, or will. Okay? So with that said, I'd like to have the first panel come up. It's people we all know and love. Well, we know.
Wait.
Please introduce yourselves to the committee, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colleagues, I'm Michael Dembro, and I represent Senate District 23. That's Northeast and Southeast Portland, Park Rose, and the City of Maywood Park. And
Paul Holby, State Representative, District 8, which is Eugene and South Central Lane County, and also Chair of the Business and Labor Committee, from which we worked collaboratively with Senator Dembro's Senate Committee on Workforce to craft the engrossed bill, which came before you. And we're here to speak to that and some of the changes that you're looking at in front of you.
Right. So let's start off just by quickly walking you through the process of what got us here today. Back in 2013, there was paid sick leave legislation was considered, and the upshot of it was that a task force was created to explore this issue and to look at what a statewide earned sick leave policy could look like. And the good Senator Steiner Hayward was the Senate chair of that committee. Representative Vega Peterson was the House chair of that committee. It included a variety of stakeholders and met for 2 years. The product of that was the parallel bills, 454 and 2700, was it?
2005.
House Bill 2005 on the House side. They were identical. Those were the bills as introduced. And they were referred to the Business and Labor Committee and to the Workforce Committee. And we knew that they were going to have a lot more work to do. The goal here was, there's a strong belief that workers need paid sick leave wherever they live in this state, wherever they work. It's kind of a labor standard similar to the 40-hour work week, something that workers need to be able to balance their lives with their work. But how to do that in a way that would be as easy to implement and as least burdensome on business as possible, that was the challenge. In the interim, Portland had gone ahead and enacted its own sick leave ordinance. By the time this session began, it had been in effect for a year. So we had a certain amount of experience that we could look at, you know, from the Portland experience. And we decided that the best way to handle this was to, you know, really work closely together in a bicameral way, and to have parallel information hearings on the introduced bills, and then a joint public hearing in the evening on the bills, which we did, and it was really good. We had a lot of turnout from people reflecting a variety of interests. We got a lot of input, which we then followed up on by targeted one-on-one meetings with a variety of stakeholders, employer groups that we knew had, you know, concerns, and we wanted to get their best thinking. And that became the framework then for a subsequent work group that we created that was a stakeholder work group that met a couple of times, and that the result of which was our bills. You want to add anything to that, Paul?
No, I think that sort of summed up our process very, very well. I will say that we did listen to proponents and opponents in the work group, and really did take some of their issues and try to incorporate the best thinking in making this workable as we could. And certainly, I don't think either side was extremely totally got what they wanted out of this process. I really feel like we did sort of hit a middle ground on the dash or the engrossed bill as we came out of this process. Certainly, there was, you know, some additions, and the reason that we're here is because it does have a Ways and Means implication, and as chairs of the policy committees, we also recognize that we needed another compromise in the bill to move the employer size from 6 to 10 as far as being the employers that are required to have paid sick leave, that the employee size of that of the employer would move up, and that we also needed to consider, and we both agreed that we would work towards grandfathering in Portland. And so that's why you see the change in policy in front of you now, is essentially to accomplish those two things going forward, is essentially moving the employee size from 6 to 10 for the employers, and to grandfather Portland in. And so that's the substantive policy change that, as chairs, we are recommending to the Ways and Means Committee.
And I will say that that sounds easy. I mean, getting to that point is difficult, you know, agreeing that a standard of 10 with grandfathering of Portland sounds easy, but the drafting of it turned out to be a little bit more difficult than we had expected. So the Dash 25s were our attempt to do that. But since then, some problems have surfaced just with the drafting of it. And so hence the Dash 29s. And hence there will be a further set as because, you know, if we're going to do this, we want to get it right. We want to get it exactly right. Better to take a couple more days and get it just right.
Stay in the two digits, though, right?
I wouldn't count on it.
Yeah, no, this is not higher ed governance representative. But we'll be able to keep this under 100. What we passed out to you, and for the public, it's on OLIS, a snapshot of the major issues that are included in this program. And here you'll see the major attributes, as well as in parentheses the reference to the particular section of the bill that deals with these. And I thought that we would you know, quickly run through them with you and then, you know, take any questions that you might have about details.
Senator, could I ask the, just a second, talk to the committee here? I assume most of you have read the bill. If I'm wrong, stop me. And I thought we might go directly to questions. The last time this was at a public hearing, a huge amount of time was taken up going over things people knew and not getting into the questions. And I really want to get this public testimony done today. And so that, I don't mean to cut you off.
No, no, that's absolutely fine.
But
that's
I think most of us, what you've given us so far is a nice summation. But I kind of knew all this information already before you said it, because I've been here a couple of days.
That's fine.
Okay. So, Representative Boone, did
I
you?
I do. I just, and thank you, Senator Bates. I just got this today, of course, but I've read the other, the 27s, 25s, 27s, 28s, 29s, so you just said now there may be some more. So from this, and this is the 29s.
Right.
What do you expect to have changed?
Okay, just a second. So is it agreed that we're going to go right straight to questions with everybody? Is that okay?
I think
you
have,
okay, and what we're going to do is don't say follow-up. Just do it. Okay, we haven't got time today. So please ask your questions and follow up with your questions if you don't get the answer you're looking for or you're not clear.
Great.
Representative Boone.
So that was my, did you get that? What, from the 20, from this, these 29s, you said there are now going to be additional amendments, and I'm just wondering what we might expect in those additional ones.
So there are a couple of things that have surfaced in the effort to define employer, and particularly this came up when we were trying to define Portland, which of course is Portland is difficult to define. You all know that.
We're not going to spend a lot of time doing that, right?
We're just talking about the grandfather of Portland.
That's right. So it, in the definition section, it's there's a reference to entities that sell services and liquids and solids. And I
think it's page 2, line 18.
Right. An employer who maintains any office, store, restaurant, or establishment in the city that sells goods, services, food, or beverages. We're going to be striking that, you know, what comes after a city, because, you know, we realize that, you know, this potentially excludes, like, nonprofits that are delivering service but are not actually selling. So there are a couple little technicalities like that. The other thing that it's going to do...
Excuse me, just a second.
Yeah.
And that's just for in Portland. I see nodding in the, behind you.
Yeah.
The change that you just defined. Striking after everything after city.
That's right.
Okay. All right, sorry.
You know, the other thing that we've really been struggling with in this bill is... Okay, so let me say that all the people that came and testified... one of the interesting things about the testimony is that we didn't hear from any businesses in Portland, where this has been in effect for a year, complaining about this. You know, certainly it had been very controversial in advance of the adoption of the ordinance, but we didn't hear from anyone coming before us that that wished that we had not done this. However, there were issues of implementation that arose, and we did hear from people about that. The notion that, you know, this could have been done in a simpler manner, or they were having problems adjusting their current paid time off policy with what was required in the ordinance. And so what we did in the bill, we created a section 4, that clarifies that paid time off policies that meet or exceed the requirements in the bill and can be used for sick leave purposes have met the standard. Okay. There has been some disagreement about, okay, so how does the language of the bill make that intent as clear as possible? And you would think that would be easy, but it's not as easy as you think. So we're working on some final language that will really clarify that. You know, so, you know, for example, the bill has a 3-month waiting period before someone can use the benefit. You start accruing under this program from day one, but you can't use it until you've worked for at least 90 days. Well, what if you have a PTO program, as a lot of employers do, where time off is based on years of seniority, right? So when you're hired, you're eligible for a week of sick leave or paid time off. And then after 2 years or 3 years or 5 years, that goes up to 10, you know, et cetera. Well, that clearly meets the standard or exceeds the standard, even though, you know, you're not accruing in the same manner as this calls for. So that's what we want to, you know, we want to make it as easy to administer as possible. But again, we have to get the language right. So that, to answer your question, that's what we're working on. We're hoping to get that resolved this morning.
And final comment. So you're looking at to fix this. What the amount of time, the number of hours or whatever, instead of how it's done. It's just the number, because you just said if they already have a paid time off program and it meets or exceeds this, that it doesn't matter how it's done then. So, I mean, they don't accrue at the same, you know, that. It's just the number
of hours. The technicality, the details don't have to be identical.
Right.
But, you know, it has to be available in the same way, right? So, for example, you couldn't have a program that has a waiting period that's a year or 6 months, because that clearly would not meet or exceed, you know, the requirements here. But at the same time, it doesn't have to be identical to what's in here. That, I think, is our intent. Would you agree, Rick?
Yes.
I'm going to start at the far end, because I saw Representative Stark's hand up first, but it probably wasn't.
Thank you, Chair. I think three questions.
Let's say Stark.
One of them is Eugene's sick leave law. They had a minimum number of hours that had to be worked in the year for this to apply. I think it was like 250 hours per year. I thought there was a minimum. Is there any sort of minimum on this of what employees have to work in the entire year in order to occur?
No, there's not. I mean, there's a 3-month waiting period, and the accrual is tied to the amount, you know, the amount that you work. So someone who's working, you know, a very small amount is not going to accrue very much sick leave. You know, it's one for every 30 hours, 1 hour of sick leave for every 30 hours that you work.
And I saw one portion of the bill that I think attempted to address this, but maybe I didn't understand it. How does this work with day labor locations? You know, a builder calls up an agency and says, yeah, I need a guy for the day to come dig ditches. How does that apply to those businesses? How would that work?
So the responsible person here is the contractor that the laborer works for. You know, it's not the homeowner or, you know, the project manager. So So what's being looked at is not, you know, is not where the person is working, but who the employer is, and wherever the employer is located, that's where the employer size standard kicks in. So if the employer is located in Portland, you know, this contractor employer is located in Portland, then the 6-employee standard kicks in. If they're located in Gresham, then the 10-employer standard kicks in.
So if they're if it's an agency that employs day labor people and sends them out, then that's on the agency, not the contractor.
Correct.
One other, would you elaborate on the Dash 29s, maybe spend just a moment talking about the ag worker exception or the seasonal worker exception and how that would work with the Dash 29s, since I don't know how much that was gone over in previous hearings.
Yeah, we talked about it at length.
Okay, yeah. I've only read the bill, so
No, of course. So again, if a worker is working for a labor contractor, which is increasingly the practice, then you know, that contractor is their employer, and whatever, you know, whatever their work history with that person is, you know, that requirement will kick in. If they're not working for a contractor and they're truly seasonal, they will probably be exempted under the 90-day requirement. You know, they have to they have to have worked for 90 days to be able to, you know, to use the benefit.
I'll add just a second. They aren't actually exempted. It's just going to they're not going to be able. It'll be more difficult for them to actually qualify for the sick time because they'll accrue at such a much slower rate. They're not exempted from the paid sick time.
And then if it's under 90 days, they don't have an opportunity to use it because of the 90-day wait period.
However,
they just don't accrue. Right. Aren't able
well, however, we do it. Have. So if they work for a period of time, and then there's a break in service, you know, they leave the state, they go somewhere else, work for someone else, and then they come back within 180 days, then the clock resumes.
Okay.
So it is possible, you know, if they sort of cross seasons, that they might become eligible. But they're not accruing for any of the time that they're not actually working for that employer.
Okay.
I'm going to stop questions right there for a minute. Senator Thompson just joined us, and I'm going to ask him to come up. He was tied up at 8:30, so didn't have a chance to say, you know, let us know. But I know you wanted to speak, and I think you have a little segue of what you might want to speak to on this bill. And you didn't hear the earlier conversation, but we're trying to get out of here by 10 to 10 tonight, 10 this morning, and not have to come back Monday and take more testimony. So please introduce yourself.
Co-Chair Bates, Co-Chair Nathanson, and committee. Thank you. The reason I was late, I was in seeing Senator Courtney, and you know how that is sometimes. Senator Courtney's like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get. So I did make it out alive. Thank you. Thanks for having me. I'm here basically to kind of
introduce yourself.
Talk. I see that all the time, and I still do that. Oh, Senator Chuck Thompson, District 26.
There you go.
Thank you. I live in Hood River. My family has a pear orchard there, and I'm here to mainly talk about the seasonal part of this bill. I have no qualms with. I have like 6 full-time employees, so I don't have any qualms with the full-time part. Most of my employees live on our property. We provide the housing, water, electricity, and I have probably 60-65 men and women that work for us mainly during our thinning and harvest time. There are times, and I'm kind of your average grower in Hood River. So a basic year for us would be we start pruning our trees in January. It takes about maybe a month and a half. So you might get probably 30 days in there, take away the weekends. And then the people that are working for me, the seasonal employees, will move up into the Upper Valley, Parkdale, and somewhere else in the valley. And then they're pruning, and then maybe... there's all kind of jobs. We'll maybe plant some trees in the middle. So, and then like a week from now, we'll start thinning our Bartlett pears. There's too many pears on the trees, and for them to get big enough, you have to space them out about 6 inches. That'll be about 3 weeks. And as soon as the cherries are ready to be harvested in the dalles, all our folks are out of there because they can make $200 to $300 a day picking cherries. And so they'll do that. Off and on, depending. It's all weather related because sometimes you can't work because it's raining or whatever. And then our pear season starts. We have 1 week of pears in August, and then like 3 weeks in the month of September. So what happens about the time that we're going to get into probably the end of the year is when everybody's going to get to the 90-day mark will be harvest time. So they tell me for my Bartlett pears. Just because what I'm worried about on this is the fruit is very fragile. Most fruit, whether it's blueberries, pears, cherries, we have a very limited amount of days to harvest our crops. So if we get into this, we have 8 days to pick our Bartletts, or they grade them down into the cannery level, or they just go to waste. If all my employees at that time decide to take paid sick leave, 5 days of paid sick leave, they could do that. I'm not saying they would, but it would be available to them. So I think the part in agriculture that we all have to remember is we're dealing with perishable crops, and those kind of things aren't addressed in this bill. I've got, they're pretty slow. down in LFO. There's several amendments in the works still. I don't know if it's going to be moved out today. I've seen amendments to move it from 90 days on seasonal workers only to 180, and that doesn't include labor contractors. These are just seasonal ag workers that aren't tied to contractors, because none of our folks are in. There's no contracting, but so I'm not talking about the contracting part. So it's just ag labor, and then I have a bill that if that doesn't work, that would settle for maybe 120 days. So there's several options out there. I think Rep. Olson has a amendment in the works too. Maybe we'd see. I'm not sure of that, but so there are some options to this. I'm not saying. I don't think this body is. Probably I would like an ag exemption altogether, but I don't think this body's going to do that. But I think at least the seasonal thing needs to be looked at, or it would be devastating to ag. Thank you.
Just a quick question, and I think the bill we're looking at right now has 180 days in it. Is that correct?
No, it's a 90-day waiting period.
But if
you come back to the same employer within 180 days, then the clock resumes,
which would affect most farmers.
Yeah. So, but I do need to say just a couple of things. One is that, you know, if you've worked for 90 days, you're going to be eligible for only a minimal amount of sick leave, right? Because you're accruing by the hour, and so, you know, for someone to be able to take 5 days of sick leave. There you're talking about your full-time employees, not your seasonal employees. You know, the other thing is that, you know, and we had a lot of testimony about this, agricultural workers they get sick as well, right? And you don't want a sick agricultural worker working with your foodstuffs. And it's very difficult. It's hard work. We heard a lot of argument that agricultural workers need leave as much as anyone does. Their work is so difficult physically.
I'm going to go Senator Hayward first, and then we'll come back to you.
Thanks. Senator Thompson, I wonder if you could help me clarify something. And I don't mean to come across as snarky, and I apologize in advance if I do. You know, it strikes me that I don't know what base pay you would pay, but most people would probably earn more in a day working than they would if whatever rate you would pay them if they took sick leave, right? Let's start with that question.
Oh, absolutely.
Right. So if I had to guess, I mean, Senator Dembrough is exactly correct. If you have somebody who has a significant gastrointestinal illness, for example, you don't want them handling the food that they're harvesting because that's bad, right?
No.
But you also, I mean, and in that case, it's probably reasonable to encourage them to stay home so at least they earn something rather than nothing, which they would earn if they didn't have earned sick leave.
Right. Yes, and I'm talking about the worst case scenario.
I understand that. But
perishable crops.
Right.
Everybody decides to take. So here's.
Yeah.
And when you're harvesting, the labor situation, during harvest is very competitive.
I understand.
They could take sick leave, go across the valley, and pick for 5 days, and nobody would even know.
I understand that.
Yeah.
I think that it's possible. Certainly, mm-hmm. that people would do that. I think the chances of it are slim because I think most people are honorable. And I appreciate your concern, but I think mm-hmm. that what we're really looking at here, you know, having been one of the people who spent the last several years working on this bill, is not. I mean, there are always going to be bad actors, right? We know that. No matter what the deal is, you've got them, and you know, we all have them. But I don't think the vast majority of people working for you on a seasonal basis are likely to be in that pool. They're going to want to do the honorable thing, and they're going to want to honor their commitments. And, yes, they could, but it would mean that they'd worked for you. If they took 5 days, it would be because, as Senator Dembrough said, they'd worked full-time for you for a year. It wouldn't be your seasonal folks who would be doing that.
I'm just saying it's possible.
It is absolutely.
Yeah, it's very
possible. It's possible. I don't think it's highly likely.
Well, your life isn't on the line if it's possible either.
Mr. Chairman, if I could follow up, just colleagues, the bill does include the ability for, you know, discipline or denial of the paid leave if the employer suspects malfeasance. You know, a doctor's note can be required, certification that this person was in fact sick. And just, you know, to clarify, and the handout does clarify this, many workers, especially at the height of the season, are being paid at a piece rate for the work that they do. However, if they have to take a sick day, they're just paid at the minimum wage rate, which is, you know, as the good senator said, much lower than what they could earn from actually working, doing their piecework.
They're paid a minimum wage or what they're getting right at the time. Why would that be minimum wage?
Well, that's what the bill requires. That's the sick leave pay for somebody, you know, who's who works on a piece rate basis. They get paid the minimum wage. They don't get paid their usual piece rate. They get paid.
Well, wouldn't they get, if they're making $11 an hour, wouldn't they get $11 an hour?
If that's how they're paid.
But so
if
why would you say minimum wage?
That's if they're paid on a piece rate basis, you know, by the bushel or, you know, the way that it works for in a lot of agricultural settings.
So you're assuming we all pay minimum?
No. I'm just saying in that case in which somebody is paid on a piece rate basis, they
would get whatever they're getting now, like an hourly rate, whatever their hourly rate is.
Maybe I'll help with this. If the worker is being paid normally on an hourly basis, they would get paid that hourly basis.
Yeah.
If they're getting paid on, if they're not getting paid on a piece on an hourly basis and getting paid on a piece rate, they're required to be paid the minimum wage for the paid sick time,
not what their normal wage is.
I think what you're trying to tell him is this. If you've got people that are being paid $11, $12 an hour,
and you
never pay them on a piece basis, you know, I used to pick apples, so I know what you're talking about here. But if they took sick leave, you're going to pay them $11 an hour.
Right.
Those who might be working for you during the really heavy part of the season, they're probably not going to qualify for sick leave anyway. They're just, you know, that's just the way it is. So. But what you're concerned about is you probably have a core of workers you're paying an hourly wage year-round or close to year-round, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
They say take some leaves of absence of some type and go pick cherries without where you can make some big bucks.
Sure.
Very quickly.
Yeah.
And then they come back to you.
Yeah.
And you're wondering how this bill applies to those people. And I think we'll take that offline because I've got to get through this thing.
Okay.
But I understand your position. And I'm going to ask you to sit and talk with your fellow senators about this and see if we can come to an understanding of each other, at least. Maybe not agreement, but at least understanding, because there's some confusion here, obviously.
Okay.
Although I think I get your position.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. And you can stay if you like and answer questions. Or go on from there.
Well, it's okay. Either this or my education sub, so I'd love to sit here.
We won't tell them that. Representative Neeson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I have a question to follow up on something that was just mentioned about if it's the section regarding medical verification. If you suspect that there's some other reason that someone is deciding that they want to take sick leave and you feel like it's not legitimate, this may be more related to just labor law than this particular bill on sick leave, but do employees know ahead of time that they may be asked to confirm this, or is it all right for an employer to tell them that without being considered a harassment? In other words, can you say that this is one of the rules about working here?
One of the elements of the bill is that elements of the program need to be posted in the workplace the way that other, you know, requirements are. I think we have some flexibility. They have to be posted, or the employees need to be notified. And BOLI is going to help with, coming up with the forms and the communications so that they'll be standardized. But that, I believe that would have to be a part of what's communicated to the workers.
Thank you.
Follow up on that.
Okay. I want to get to the others, too, quickly.
Okay, follow up on that. Why is it a federal deal, or why is the employer required to pick up the doctor tab of that, requesting that note?
It actually is present law.
That's federal
law? I just found out that this morning.
Okay. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
It's present law.
Yes.
Now, Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask a couple of questions about the temporary employment. The 90 days is 3 months of someone working full-time, or is it actually 90 days? Because I'm assuming that if you're bouncing around at different jobs, 90 days would actually be more than 3 months, because you've got five days. Is that correct?
I think it's 90 calendar days, isn't it?
Mm.
I think the bill says.
But it is 90 calendar days, but it's only while that person is employed with that particular employer. So if they're the seasonal worker that changes jobs and goes to another employer, then the 90 days calendar days stop at that point.
And in fact, it would take a lot longer then, because you're not counting weekends. It's not 3 months. It's actually, it would take a lot longer to accrue, I'm assuming.
Yeah, it's only work hours.
Right.
You accrue that 1 hour of leave for every 30 hours worked.
Okay, but in terms of the probational period, or the period under which it could start, if they worked at Senator Thompson's for 2 weeks and then went somewhere else, those 2 weeks would be counted as 14 days or 10 days?
I think this calendar, the clock runs when they're working.
Okay. So it would go through the weekend.
Generally, like when we're working, mm-hmm. seasonal work, mm-hmm. Like pruning, mm-hmm. Our guys, we have to make them take a day off because mm-hmm. they're making a couple hundred bucks a day doing that work. Mm-hmm. So we would generally work 5 days, Monday through Friday, and half a day on Saturday. So 50 hours a week. And so sometimes it rains. Like you go to work at 8 o'clock in the morning, and it starts raining at 9, it rains all day, so you've worked a day, even though you only worked 1 hour, so that's probably going to accrue. So it's not that hard to get to 90. It's really fast to get to 90 days.
And so, how Senator Thompson, how long is your typical worker, seasonal worker, how many days over a year are they typically with you?
Typicals are typical, and I think we're pretty typical in the Hood River area. That's all I can really judge it by is
right.
what I do. I'm sure there's other people out here that can give you different information. I'm saying around 100 to 110 days generally mm-hmm. On our seasonal workers. Then we have six other full-times that work right. not, they don't work because we're a lot based on weather. So
right.
if it's raining and snowing, or it's in the winter after harvest, and once we get the orchard cleaned up, then we're just basically working on equipment, and three or four of those employees don't work for maybe a month, but they would still fit in the full-time thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But it would presumably take a long time for a worker to be able to accrue because they're working for several different employers.
I'd say by August, our employees would hit 90 days.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have a whole month of September and part of October left. And then we do cleanup and those kind of things. So probably by August in our operation, all our seasonal workers would hit 90 days.
Mm-hmm. And that could be carried over to the next year. Is that correct?
Because we'll start in January again.
Right.
So that's way under the 180-day return thing. Yeah. So 120 days, I think, would work better for most ag folks.
Well,
but the basis is basically the basis
for the workers.
If you look at seasonal worker, what constitutes a seasonal worker,
uh-huh.
it's 180 days and less, or 180 days and less. So 180 is a standard.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two real quick questions, and they both kind of refer to Section 4. First one being around the idea of record keeping and those requirements. So if you have an employer who has a generous PTO, a personal time off policy right now, from the way I'm reading this, will they be, will this apply to them for the record-keeping part?
No, I don't believe that it would. I mean, they have to keep records because they're employers, and, you know, so they have to, you know, they have to report on those, you know, as part of their taxes and everything. But you know, we don't envision that they would have to do any additional record keeping. We tried to simplify this as much as possible, actually, for all employers. The original bill had a 3-year record retention, and we mm-hmm. took that out. And, you know, that is our goal, to try to make this, you know, so that, you know, it's as simple as possible. And, I mean, obviously it's not enough for an employer to have available a policy. They actually have to implement their policy, you know, they have to follow their policy, but presumably they do.
And I might add to that, as far as the requirement to keep records, and here on the employer in this bill doesn't really say they have to keep those records, but if they were actually challenged that their paid time off program didn't meet the standard, they would have to be able to document that it did, and I would assume they would have to have records to do that.
Okay. Follow-up question? Thank you. Well, first of all, I just want to say you guys have really worked hard on this, and Representative Hovey, I appreciate you giving me that half hour in your business committee a few weeks back on the Dash 18s on that. Along that line, and your hard work with the follow-up work group to get to where you're at right now with the amendments, so you've moved up to the 10 level for eligibility on this. Any consideration on the 25 for the mirror the Family Medical Leave Act concept? I was just kind of curious.
We certainly, as that was certainly in the conversation in our work group. You know, the 25 number was discussed, but we also have, you know, the original bill was mm-hmm. it applied to employers to all employees. Mm-hmm. You know, at zero, and that was a policy that City of Eugene has, you know, adopted but not implemented yet, that they were going to require zero. So we had a pretty wide spectrum of opinions on that. A lot of people would say that all employees deserve some paid sick time off mm-hmm. because, you know, everybody gets sick once in a while. So we were really trying to balance that, and we're coming to 10, you know, where we, I think, our engrossed bill moved up to 6 employees, and now we're at 10. Mm-hmm. 25 was certainly offered, as you know, in the Dash 18s and amongst others as well, but we didn't really feel that would cover a lot of employees in the state of Oregon once you get to employers of that size. And, you know, it is the goal that this, you know, is a benefit for workers and, you know, quite frankly, would be beneficial to employers to make sure their workforce is productive and healthy at the same time.
Mm-hmm. So. And I might add, you know, remember that OFLA is a very substantial benefit in the sense that, you know, it's a 6-week time off, which is, you know, obviously it's going to have an impact on a business. Here what we're talking about is, you know, what will in most cases be, you know, a day at a time. So, you know, they're not exactly apples and apples. And hence, you know, just really limiting it to very small employers, the exclusion to small employers made sense.
Okay. And then just one really quick one, and it will be quick. So you have an employer that has 6 full-time employees, seasonal comes in. All of a sudden, he picks up 5 that are just temporary workers. How does this play out?
So the actual specifics of how the employer size will be calculated, we're leaving up to BOLI in rules. What they did in Portland, because BOLI also advised Portland on theirs, is to use the OFLA methodology, and I suspect they're probably going to come up with something similar here. And what OFLA does is it does a kind of look back and an average. Okay. So I don't, you know, odds are that person would not be more than 6, okay. or more than, you know, would Thank be you. Under 10.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to cut off questions of the panel here because we are running out of time. and I appreciate your hard work, and I appreciate your comments, and being open about it, and I mean, we're all going to stay on the same page as far as respecting each other and working together on this thing. That's going to be a tough build. So I'm going to ask other panels to come up.
Thanks for letting me join the panel.
Thanks for coming in. And I'm going to ask, I'm going to kind of, before people can jump up here, we've got Mr. Mike Nesmith, who's here from Lane County. Sure. We'd like to give individuals who are a long distance away to come up and speak first. Mr. Nesmith, I'm going to hold you to about 3 minutes. But I'd like to hear your testimony, then we're going to bring up our invited panels.
Co-Chair Bates, Co-Chair Nathanson, committee members, thank you very much for allowing me to speak. My name is Mike Nesbitt. I've been with Papa's Pizza Parlors for 40 years, 41 years this past March. I started as a dough roller, and I'm president of the company now. We want to have sick leave for our employees. We already offer a number of benefits for our employees. My concern with the current legislation is that it's not taking into account the impact of part-time employees on a business such as ours. We have a lot of high school and college kids, and they really, I've never had anybody ask me for sick leave. What they want is time off to go to the beach, time off to go to parties, time off to go to dances, and so we give them those opportunities. When we're looking at, I have over 400 employees, 95% of those are part-time. And those part-time employees, the record-keeping on this, number one, is going to be almost incomprehensible to try to deal with that. But if you break down the numbers that we're talking about in this current bill, it's about 25 hours per week in order to qualify for the 40 hours maximum. And that's what I would be happy with. If you just said 25, you work 25 hours per week, you're going to get sick leave, I'd be fine with that. What you're doing is taking college kids and high school kids and saying, we're going to be shifting a lot of hours to those who are going to get the sick leave, and you're going to be losing opportunities. We already have cut, because of the increase in minimum wage and other increases in employee costs, we've already cut about 4,000 hours per year through various ways. I mean, buying pre-sliced meats and pre-prepared salad fixings and stuff like that. If the sick leave now is going to give us an incentive to shift hours from the really low part-time employees to those we know are already going to get their 40 hours of sick leave, and so we're going to be sacrificing a certain number of those employees. And I don't think that that gets looked at all when we're talking about this kind of a proposal. We look at the big cities, Portland, Eugene. We ignore the smaller towns, and it gets frustrating. It's very frustrating for me. Is that my cutoff there?
Well, kind of. Keep going.
Okay. I've been to a lot of these hearings, and I do get really frustrated because the employers who are employing so many part-time employees don't seem to be represented. In Eugene, they had restaurant companies speaking, but those restaurant companies already offered sick leave to most of their employees. I don't, because it's not something my employees want. We give our employees benefits that they ask for. We allow them to trade shifts. We work around their high school and college schedules. We do everything we can for them. This is going to make that harder, and it's going to take away benefits from those employees, things that are important to them. It's not that I'm going to go bankrupt, which is what one employer, our representative suggested, that Portland employers would be coming and saying, well, this drove us out of business. That's not the issue at all. The issue is that the employees themselves are going to suffer. So I do thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Thanks for coming all the way up here this morning. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Nesbitt, I really appreciate the predicament you're in, and I appreciate the work that you and others like you are doing to provide benefits to your employees and to work with them to accommodate their schedules and everything. And that's hard for a lot of part-time workers, college students, moms, you know, and I think it's wonderful that Papa Murphy's is really working
Papa's
hard
Pizza.
To Papa's Pizza. I'm so sorry. I heard Papa Murphy when someone cared over here, and I'm terribly sorry, Mr. Nesbitt. I really apologize. I'm very sorry. I do apologize for my slip. Regardless, that your business is doing all that you do to support your workers. What I'm curious about right now, and I get that your workers aren't asking for this sick leave as a benefit, take one of your college students who's working part-time, and believe me, I've got a daughter in college, I know how that goes. What happens right now if one of them gets a really bad cold or a GI bug or something like that? How does that play out in your business when they're supposed to work?
We don't allow them to work sick, number one, our managers. I mean, my managers are, this is what they do for a career. Most of my managers have 15, 20 years on the job. The employee themselves will call in sick. And then if they need more money to make up for that, they'll trade with somebody else who wants the night off for a dance or wants the night off to go to the beach or whatever. And they do that all the time. They do it whether to make up hours for sick being sick or to make up hours for doing something else. They have that flexibility because they aren't working 25 hours in a week. They're working 15, 18. They have the flexibility to be able to do that.
That's great. And my understanding is that the way the bill's structured, that shift trading is also allowed in lieu of sick time at this point. So that's that still is a possibility people wouldn't use the sick time.
Correct. But we still have to track the sick time. It's still theirs, and they can still use it if they choose to use it. And then after it requires 3 days for them being sick before we can even find out if they actually were sick. And that's not saying that our employees are going to take advantage of us, but I've been doing this for over 40 years, and employees will call in sick when they aren't sick.
Yeah.
And
no,
if we're paying them for it, that's going to be a problem.
I completely get where you're coming from, and I understand that there are bad actors, as I said to Senator Thompson. I get that. I really do. I guess I'm thinking about the college student who breaks a bone or gets appendicitis or something like that that really takes them out of work for more than a day or so or even part of a chunk of a week, you know, that really is going to keep them out for a while, and trying to make sure that, you know, we know how many college students are living on the edge in terms of their finances, and I worry about that piece of it too. I don't think there's a good answer to this. I get that. I do hear where you're coming from. I also am trying to balance the needs of kids who are trying to get their way through an education or moms who are trying to add a little bit to the family coffers.
One quick response here.
Sure.
Those employees that are working 15 hours a week are likely to have to be with us for over 2 years before they would get enough accumulated sick leave in order to make up for a extended period of being off.
Understood.
And so we're really talking about some that we're tracking for very few hours over the entire course of years and years before they can accumulate even the 40 hours.
Okay, I hear you.
I'm going to stop questions at this point because we're going to run out of time. We've got two panels to get through. Mr. Nesbitt, thank you for coming up today.
Thank you all.
I heard when I got out of this, it was 25 hours, and we'll have a discussion offline. Okay? So we're going to call up two panels, and we want to get through this in half an hour, and so I'm going to hold those panels with pretty tight timelines. Otherwise, we're back here Monday doing this all over again. I don't think anybody wants to do that. So I will call up Betsy Earls, Katie Fast, and Bill Perry, please. And you guys know who's on deck. Andrea Peluso, Jeff Anderson, and Matt Swanson. So please introduce yourself and give us your testimony, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries, and appearing before you in opposition to Senate Bill 454. Before I get started with my formal testimony, I wanted to call out one conversation that I heard a little earlier with the prior panel. I was listening with about half an ear, and I'm not sure if I understood the response correctly, but there was some conversation about how an employee goes about meeting the 90-day threshold before they can take leave. Is that correct? And whether that was 90 days worked or 90 calendar days. I would point out to you, I'm looking at the amendments, but if you go to Section 3, Sub 4, Sub A, the language that actually talks about that says an employee is eligible to use sick time beginning the 91st calendar day of employment with the employer. And I think it's an open question about whether that is days worked or calendar days, because our opinion is that even when employees aren't actually at work, they're still employed by our members, by our employers. So I would argue that every single day is a day that counts in that 90 days, whether or not the employee is actually at work. To get started with this conversation, the Legislative Revenue Office a few months ago evaluated the cost of providing a refundable tax credit that would be equivalent to the amount that covered employers would spend in providing paid sick leave under the terms of Senate Bill 454. That number varies, and you've probably seen it, depending on your estimate of how many Oregon employees don't currently have sick leave, but either way, we find it staggering. Proponents say that roughly 47% of Oregon workers don't have paid sick leave. If this is the case, a tax credit that would cover the cost of newly provided leave would be roughly $976 million over 2 years. We see that as quite a bit of money. Even if we're using Legislative Revenue's original estimate of the number of workers without paid sick leave, which was 36%, the cost to Oregon employers over 2 years is about $745 million. And that's a refundable tax credit, not a non-refundable tax credit. I think regardless of whether you exempt the very smallest businesses, Senate Bill 454 is at its core a small business issue. It really treats small businesses like they're capable of absorbing the same costs that larger employers can absorb, and forces them to make choices about benefits that may or may not reflect the wishes and values of their particular workforce. All mandates come at a cost, and I would point out to you that Senate Bill 454 is no different. Medium and larger sized businesses might be able to better absorb the costs of these policies, but the reality is that if most small businesses could afford these benefits, they would already be offering them. Oregon has already some of the most expansive family leave laws in the country, and our generous employer discrimination and accommodation laws apply even to the very smallest businesses. We have the second highest minimum wage in the United States, and Oregon businesses also pay the highest unemployment taxes in the country to support the unemployed. Senate Bill 454, I think basically what I want to tell you is going to be a real hit to small businesses and medium-sized businesses in particular, and we ask that you take a very, very careful look at what this will cost not only the state but the business community as you consider moving forward.
Good morning. For the record, Katie Fast with the Oregon Farm Bureau. I think Senator Thompson today did a good job of talking about what the impact would be on the Hood River sector and his business. But as you're taking in consideration this legislation, you have to remember that we raise over 200 crops throughout Oregon, and each farm's unique. And for many of my members, probably the majority of them, they're not doing a one-crop harvest like Senator Thompson, but they're doing a mixture of different crops, and that changes year to year depending on markets and landscapes. Farm Bureau does oppose Senate Bill 454. At the very least, we believe because of the unique nature of agriculture, it should be exempt, especially the seasonal and temporary workers. We, in addressing the A-28 amendments, there's a few areas of concern just in the drafting of those. The first one being around the trigger of 10 employees. It's very unclear, as you heard, on if those would be full-time or part-time employees. Our position is that that trigger should be based on full-time employees. For many of our members, they will have 4 to 5 full-time employees, but will bring in for a certain amount of time. That's going to vary between operation, but for 2 weeks, bring in 30 folks to harvest a crop. You can read this draft that they would be triggered to have the full requirements of all the bill. We heard on the previous panel that they felt like this would be handled by BOLI. We are uncomfortable with that. We believe that the legislature should be the ones to make those final clarifications so that you can hear this discussion that's coming forward. Additionally, in Section 312, or Section 3, Sub 12, that brings in the different requirements for larger cities. We have concerns with that section. It talks about that it includes but not limited the definition of employers being restaurants, stores, and establishments. I have several members who operate outside of the Portland city limits. Hood River is a great example. But then they'll participate in the Portland farmers market. Is a farm stand at a farmer's market considered an establishment? Is a farm stand that you set up for 2 months out of the year to sell your crops in a parking lot of a store considered an establishment? We are very concerned that farms that operate outside of city limits will be triggered by that requirement. It creates a large part of confusion for their employers, for these employers. And it's a challenge that they have with the current Portland requirements right now. And then I'd also like to expand on the comments around the 90 days that Betsy started out with. There was a lot of discussion on the previous panel, but in a farm operation, even though an employee might be working multiple jobs, they do not actually terminate their employment during that time period. I would keep them on a payroll, even though they might be going and working on a neighbor. And maybe they don't work for me for 2 weeks, and then they come back. They're still, I think, classified as an employee during that time, even though they're working in and out. So we would agree with Senator Thompson that that window maybe needs to be larger, or in a better scenario, those employees exempted out. And I'm happy to answer questions.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Bates, members of the committee. Bill Perry, the Oregon Restaurant Lodging Association. I want to start by saying I participated in the work group that Senator Dembro and they had, and I do appreciate everything. They did a lot of things like fixing the shift trading that's coming up before. So they've improved the bill immensely from the Portland and the Eugene ordinances from my vantage point. But I do want to kind of talk. There's a cost to this to business. I mean, we can argue about high or low or anything else, but there's a cost. And I do think the previous speaker, the other thing I just want to make sure is clear is the fewer hours a person works, whether or not they utilize a benefit or not, the cost of administrating that benefit is just higher for a lower hour worker. It just is. If you got a full-time worker, it's easier to implement a cost. And so what generally happens on these is what it does is it reduces the part-time workers. It does. And whether it's good or bad, I mean, we can argue, but the economics is economics. And so part of the problem is trying to implement these policies and part-time workers just doesn't always help, because there's a lot of people working in our industries because of the flexibility of the scheduling. So an employer is going to want to stay open. He's going to make an adjustment. He's going to change his benefits. He's going to reduce hours. He's going to raise prices. I mean, depending on the way their business works, any of those options are going to be available to them. But that's why what we have been arguing and some other business groups is the preemption is really what matters most in this piece of legislation, because, as I say, there's going to be a cost. And if you're a good business person, you're going to write a business plan to try to figure out, how do I make up this cost? And I can probably do that and stay open. If you're most business places, they can survive. A lot of bad things happen, weather, economics, everything else. But the problem that's happening in today's environment is when you guys leave the building, what's the next greatest thing from the city? It's going to be something else. It's going to be flex shifts. It's going to be retirement. And so you get these staggered things that happen on a consistent basis, and that's what really, really hurts employment. There's no stability in the marketplace. We need stability if you want to incur costs. And so that's just it has to be part of this argument. And there's also a lot of unknowns. In other, you know, what's going to happen to part-time employees at local governments? What's going to happen to part-time employees at schools? All those budgets are outside of this process. But once again, when you guys leave the building and they need money, where do they come to? And, you know, it's a, you know, I just think this has to be thought of is, if this is a benefit that this body truly feels we need, how are we going to bring some stability to the business community once you leave this, so we can try to control and write a business plan? The only other thing is, one of the reasons why we did a the bill was to get uniformity. I'm not going to sit here and argue 5 or 10 employees, but it would just be nice if it's the same for everybody. I know Portland is this, and you want to leave them at 5, but if it's 5, leave it at 5. If it's 10, leave it at 10. Why, if we're going for stability and uniformity, why are we setting two different standards? So pick one. It is the only thing I ask for, because there are people that have businesses in Portland and outside of Portland. It'd just be nice if they could be uniform. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
We're going to have 3 minutes for questions, and that's it, because the other panel has to come. I'm timing this. I know.
No.
Did you have a question real quick?
Representative Kenny Garrick can go ahead.
Kenny Garrick.
Question, Katie, I wonder if you have any statistics on how many employers start their employment and keep it open versus end employment.
Chair Bates, Representative Kenny Geyer, unfortunately, I don't right now. I don't think we, there's not a record-keeping system for that. We do at Farm Bureau offer some human services type advising services. I can check with them and follow up, but I think it's hard to tell, but I'll see if I can get an answer for you after.
That'd be great, because my concern was actually going in the opposite direction, that if people are working in, for 3 or 4 different employers, it's going to take forever to be able to accumulate any hours, enough hours. So my concern was not 120, 180. I was thinking about going back the other way. So I'm just really curious about whether their employment stays open or whether someone works for a week and they really only accumulate five days. Whereas if you're regularly employed, you're 7 days a week.
I'm going to cut off questions and bring up the second panel. Thank you all for your testimony. I do appreciate it. Andrea Peluso, Jeff Anderson, and Matt Swanson. And we will be listening also to Jan Meekums and Stephen Michael before we leave this morning. And I'm cutting off sign-ups after that. I think I can legally do that. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Bates, members of the committee. My name is Andrea Peluso. I'm the Executive Director of Family Forward Oregon and a co-chair of the Fair Shop for All Coalition. I want to start by telling you why we're here. We have, over the last 4 years, talked to thousands, tens of thousands of Oregonians about paid sick time or their lack of paid sick time. We've heard many, too many stories, heartbreaking stories of people working sick, at restaurants, at grocery stores, of being fired for calling in sick to work, of leaving parents making the heartbreaking decision to leave kids who are far too young to be home alone when they're sick because they fear losing their job, or asking an older sibling to miss school to care for a younger sibling when they can't. We have heard actually a few heartbreaking stories from mothers who've driven to work and left their sick kid in the car outside their office because they feared losing their job. When we've heard from school employees who've talked about sick kids at school spreading illness, sick in the office, because their parents can't pick them up. We don't see this as just a benefit, having access to paid sick time. We see it as a basic labor standard and a public health standard.
So keep the microphone a little farther from your...
Okay. Yeah. We're excited to see the laws pass in Portland and Eugene, but despite those laws passing, which did offer paid sick time coverage to nearly 300,000 folks who didn't have it before, still 47% of private sector workers in this state lack access to even an hour of paid sick time. That's 71% of low-wage workers and 2/3 of Latino workers. We think that these working families deserve stability, too. Women are more likely to work in the kinds of jobs that don't have paid sick time, retail, food service, child care, home health care, and others. They're more likely to work in part-time jobs without even the most basic of benefits or protections. They're more likely to need access to this time off as well to take care of themselves or other family members. We would argue that the bill before you today is not only about an employer's bottom line, though it doesn't discount the importance of it either. It's about multiple bottom lines, those of workers struggling to make ends meet and those of employers who are doing the right thing in an environment that discourages it. It's about our community's bottom line when disease spreads or healthcare costs increase. It's about public health, economic justice, and equity. As has been noted, there's been a long process over the last couple of years that has led us to the draft before you today. Through our work groups, we've identified ways that employers can identify and take action in cases of abuse or suspected abuse. We've made record-keeping requirements basically non-existent in this draft. We've shifted language on shift trading for tipped employees. We've lengthened periods under which employees provide notice for foreseeable absences. We've changed the employer size threshold multiple times. We've preempted local governments from keeping their existing standards or passing new ones. And we've outlined specifically that if an employer already has a policy around paid time off that meets the same terms and conditions as are required in this law, that they're not required to change their existing policies. We also extended a one-year grace period under which employers will not face penalty for wage and hour claims as they adjust to this new provision. It's time for this bill to pass. A paid sick time law is critical in addressing public health and economic security issues that people across the state are experiencing right now, and these families cannot afford to wait. I wanted to address a few of the questions that have come up in previous
panels.
You're
running into your partner's time here, so you know, okay?
Do you mind? A question.
I'll yield.
Okay. Thank you. The question that Representative Stark posed about the 240-hour threshold for Eugene and Portland is about establishing the geographic boundaries and sort of what constitutes working within the city in a way that allows the city to establish jurisdiction. There's no need for such a test in a statewide standard. The 90-day waiting period explicitly says calendar days because it is supposed to be a 90-day clock that begins on the date of hire. Those are calendar days. At the end of a 90-day period, which is approximately 3 months, folks should have access to this time, whether they've worked all 90 days or not. And we want to note that the reason this law applies to part-time workers is because we've already created by law enough disincentives for employers to move people from part-time to full-time work. We don't need to add any additional tests or barriers that keep folks in suppressed hour jobs. That's why we applied an accrual rate of 1 hour for every 30 hours worked, because people will accrue the amount of time based on the amount of time they've worked. So part-time workers will accrue fewer hours. And I'd like to state they're only accruing time for hours they work. So if they work for one employer, move to another employer, come back to that employer, they're only accruing time, hours of sick time for time they're working. I hope that addresses some of those questions. Thank you.
Do we have any balance of time?
Men and women are different type of people sometimes, and we get out talked a lot, so just go ahead.
Chair of the committee, members, my name is Jeff Anderson. I'm Secretary Treasurer of United Food and Commercial Workers Local 555. We're a 20,000 member union, and I always comment that we're the largest private sector union in the state of Oregon. Our members are primarily employed in the food industry, but we have health care settings, hospitals, a number of manufacturing and agricultural processing as well. We have people going to work in the grocery stores today sick. And it's because of a kind of an anomaly. We have sick days. We have it in language. But uniquely to our industry, for whatever reason, you can only be compensated out of your sick day bank on the third day that you're sick. So if you're part-time and you work 4 days or 3 days and you have a day off in between, it's possible to lose 40% of your weekly income to 100% of your weekly income. The reality is people go to work sick today. They're the ones serving you in the delis and the fish butcher blocks, and we're also the ones that receive the sick people going home from work, coming into the store lines to get their medications, coming through our lines. And I just want to make it. Nah, I better not. There's one little joke. I'll keep it offline. It's such a wildfire with our issue of having sick days be accessed when you're sick, staying home with your family, or not losing your income. Our members aren't at the top of the economic ladder. I mean, the irony is, if you put in this law, you're creating a competitive, a non-competitive disadvantage. That means the employer or competitor down the street has to follow the same rules. So in a marketplace, that replaces kind of the, well, gee, you're adding additional cost. I would say that the bigger cost is not to the employer, it's to public health. It's to people getting sick, the norovirus that'll wipe out a classroom. 37 of 38 nations have it. It's just long overdue. I think Oregon should be a leader on this. My members are asking for you to do the right thing and make this law. And I heard one of the previous speakers, I'm willing to go to 5. I'm willing to go to 0.
Thank you.
Leave it at that.
Great. Thank you. Chairs Bates, Nathanson, my name is Matt, and members of the committee, my name is Matt Swanson. I'm the executive director of the SEIU Oregon State Council. SEIU has been part of negotiations for the past 4 years at the local level in the interim work group chaired by, that was brought together by Senator Steiner Hayward and members of this body. So we have certainly been at the table and active in the negotiations, as well as the negotiations that are currently ongoing around this bill. And I can say that this is truly a product of years of hard work. We're here to voice our strong support for Senate Bill 454A. And I would agree that, you know, ideally in a perfect world, and I think also for clarity and simplicity of implementation, this applies to all workers, right? I think for because we've been through a process and because there have been compromises made, we're now at a different threshold. And I agree to with Mr. Perry that predictability could be good, and it is a matter of economics. I think what is clear for our members is that this is, for family economics, this is a challenge. When you can't afford to put a roof over your head and figure out how to stay home to care for a sick child, and workers that we've encountered in especially low-income industries, the choice is that you give that child a dose of ibuprofen, send them to school, and hope that you don't get a call that they need to go home because their fever has spiked. With workers who care for vulnerable populations, they are too faced with the challenge of, do I risk getting my client sick and impacting our health system, or do I pay my bills? These are real challenges that Oregonians are facing, and that's I think the cause for this law coming forward. At times we've had to address some of these real challenges that families face and the value of our work. And I think some basic paid and earned sick time is an important value that we need to put out there as a state. I guess without going too far, too much further, I know that this committee will be taking this online and hopefully moving this bill forward, but I would just say that this is both an economic crisis and a public health crisis. I think that passing this law this session will go a long ways towards valuing Oregon's families, and I believe that this is the right investment to make in people, and we think we have a good product that should move forward. So thank you for your time, and I will be available for questions.
Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chair, can I just ask a real quick question?
Yes, we have 3 or 4 minutes. Go.
So, Andrea, I greatly appreciate all your work on this, especially going out to tens of thousands of Oregonians and their stories. Could you provide me some documentation of the incidents involving the sick kids left at school, the sick kids left in cars, as well as the sick kids left at home? I mean, I'd be interested in, like, maybe police reports, newspaper articles, those kind of things.
We don't have newspaper articles or police reports. We have people's individual submissions of their stories to us, either online or in person, out in the field, door to door.
Okay, again, I'd like to have the documentation on that.
I'm happy to provide that.
And then just one other really quick. Matt. Mm-hmm. Did you ever get a chance to see the Dash 18s? I mentioned those earlier. It sets the limit at 25 for the employers, and it fits in with what the Family Medical Leave Act is providing right now. I'd be curious your thoughts on that.
And I think this was clarified earlier. I think that you're talking about the OFLA standard, correct? And I believe that is a far more expansive standard. We would like the lower threshold because I think for a couple of reasons. I think primarily this is a benefit that needs to go out to more workers. I think the other piece is that I would say it's a basic labor standard, and I don't think a threshold that high would be the benefit we'd like to see. So.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you, and thank you all for testifying today. We appreciate your time. Thank you. I'm going to call up Jan Meekums and Stephen Michael. You can introduce yourself to the panel and give your testimony. Thank you.
Okay. Good morning. My name is Senator Bates and members of the committee. My name is Jan Meekums. I'm the state director for NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business. We've been advocating for small businesses since 1943. We have 7,000 privately owned members in the state of Oregon, and we have about 350,000 members nationwide. We are very experienced with small business. We are in opposition of Senate Bill 454, but I would like to say this has been a very robust process. It's been a very respectful process of both sides, and I really appreciate how it's been approached, even though at this point in time we're not in support of the final bill. We appreciate what's been done and how you've arrived at where we are today. We appreciate the 10, that the threshold right now is 10 employees. We, of course, would prefer to have the OFLA threshold of 25. We have, our members are all types of members. We do have a lot in ag. We have a lot in restaurants. We have them in every make and shape and size of entrepreneurship in the state. When we polled our members on a mandated paid sick leave, 95% of our members were opposed. That is not because many of them themselves offer paid sick leave. It was not because they would not want to give paid sick leave, as was said by Mr. Nesbitt. I have yet to meet a small business employer that says, I don't want to give paid sick leave. They all would like to, as they are able to financially. And so what they do instead is it's a very customized environment that they provide sick leave based on the needs and wants of their members. We did a poll of time, a requested time off of our members. 92% of them gave the time that was requested. Only 2% denied it. And so they really work. And I would also like to argue that there was testimony regarding the Portland and the Eugene paid sick leave programs that created problems on February 16th. There was at least two small businesses from those areas that testified complaints. To give you a specific on one of our members, she has 30 employees. The Portland paid sick leave cost her $35,000. That $35,000 came directly out of the profit sharing that they share with their employees. So it costs their employees dearly. And as we've heard, it also will cost jobs. As Mr. Nesbitt said, he's cut 4,000 hours. So for this the reasons given by my peers who are also opposed to the bill, at this point in time in this version, we are opposed to the bill. And thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Yes.
Good morning, Chair Bates, Chair Nathanson. My name is Stephen Michael. I'm the State Director for the Main Street Alliance of Oregon. We work directly with small business owners all across the state. For the past 8 years in the state, we've been walking business districts in Portland and Eugene and Hood River and Klamath Falls and Pendleton, all over the state. And I think one thing that sets us apart is we take the time to really go and sit down with our members to figure out where these problems really are. And I'd say that time and time again, one thing that I hear from our members is, you know, small business owners are problem solvers.
And I think that Ms. Meekums was just talking about how a lot of her business owners that they work with have gotten really creative about ways to make sure that they're doing things that work well for their business and for their employees. And I think one thing that we love about Senate Bill 454 is that ability for business owners to be creative, to make sure that they can have a policy that meets or exceeds this basic workplace standard, this basic minimum standard that we're working to set here. I mean, we're talking about different kinds of industries have different needs, and I think it's important to remember that, especially taking out of all the reporting requirements that have been taken out of previous editions of this bill, this allows small business owners to be creative, to really solve those problems and really make sure that they're doing things that not only benefit their employees but benefit their business. And I think that you've heard today from a lot of opponents of this bill talking about the costs of this. No one's been talking about the benefits. We talk to small business owners who have policies like this. We talk to small business owners who don't have policies like this. Everyone talks about the folks that we talk to with policies like this talk about the increased retention. They talk about the increased productivity. They talk about just the loyalty that they have from their employees. They talk about the buy-in that they have from their employees. What we're arguing here is that what we need to do is set a basic minimum standard so then small business owners who want to do this can afford to do it because their big box competitors have to. And so I think that what we're really talking about is a race to the top. I think Oregon has an opportunity to really set an example for the rest of the country and allow small business owners to be creative, to make sure that we're able to invest in our employees by providing basic workplace standards like this, but that allows us to invest in our communities, because after all, everybody does get sick, and it's important that we make sure that we take the time to get better so then we can come back to the workplace and be as productive as we can be. Thank you for your time. Please support Senate Bill 454, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
Well, thank you both for your testimony. I do appreciate it. I also appreciate today's discussion. It's been very good. If there's not any burning questions, then I will close a public testimony on Senate Bill 454. We'll be carrying this over to Monday. We may or may not have a work session by that time, depending on what amendments are prepared. I expect that we will probably not have a work session until later in the week, so people have a chance to see those amendments. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you all for your time. Thank you all for your time.